You're listening to Normal Adult Human, a podcast about all the responsibilities you never knew you'd have. I'm Morgan Watt.
And I'm Charlie Ambler. Today we are talking about imposter syndrome.
I don't belong here, do you?
No, sometimes I don't feel like I do.
I don't know that I ever really felt like I belonged. And that's like it's a pretty constant thing in my life. And I think it's more common than people let on. I read somewhere that it's like 20% of the population experiences imposter syndrome.
Yeah. I've thought like recently I had a day where I felt really down in myself and yeah. I thought, oh, this is imposter syndrome. But then I'm like, I think it might be something more close to like an inferiority complex where I feel like I don't feel like I haven't achieved anything or that I'm not competent, but I feel like I'm never doing things as well as I should be doing them.
I feel like that's related to imposter syndrome.
Similar, but not like, I don't feel like a sheep in wolf's clothing, you know?
Right. But I think that the feeling of inadequacy, like you feel like you're just waiting for someone to be like, hey, you know, what are you doing here?
Right.
You know, like that feeling is very much a part of imposter syndrome.
Yeah. I guess I get this feeling of it's always with work where like, you know, if everything were to go south and I tried to find a real job, someone would say, that's what you've been doing for the past 5 years. And I'd say, yeah, but I have all these skills. And they would say, no, you don't. That's like the right. Fear. That's the crux of it. Do you just get it with everything or do you get it with specific things? Like, do you think specific things trigger it for you?
I can't think of any specific triggers other than perhaps like my own confidence on any given day.
Uh-huh.
Right. So if I'm having a rough time for some reason,
yeah,
I definitely feel like I'm like a glowing red beacon where at any moment someone's just going to be like, you do not fucking belong here, you know? And that could be like in my work, it could be like at my kid's school. It could be, you know, like interacting with my own friends. Sometimes there's times where I'm just like, what the fuck is going on? Like, is this life? Am I living my life? Who am I? You know?
Yeah.
And that's why I feel like the inadequacy thing is directly related, because it's often tied up in that, in a sense of inadequacy. Right. I mean, for me at least, it's symptomatic of a larger depression. Like when I experience that there is something larger going on that I'm maybe not addressing fully in the moment.
Yeah. Like
I don't know. It could be any, like right now, like the last little while, my sort of mental real estate has been taken up a lot by like external family issues or my mom's health is deteriorating. And so a lot of my thought, active and subconscious thought, is directed at that situation and stressing about it and feeling equally helpless and like I'm doing as much as I can.
Yeah.
And it's a weird feeling because she lives on the other side of the country and, you know, I have all this like guilt about like, did I abandon my like family? Like my, you know what I mean? Like, I moved away. Is that on me? But my mom would never say that, you know, she'd always wanted me to do what was right for me and right for my family. And So moving to a different city was never, she would never view it as like an abandoning thing.
Right.
Right. But that is like something that's like a larger situation that would affect my day to day of being like, oh Jesus. Like I feel like, an alien in a human suit sometimes, or like,
yeah,
where it just seems like nothing I'm doing is the right thing. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, for sure. I feel that too. Like, usually comes when I'm, it's funny. It never comes when I'm comparing myself to people that I know, but then when I compare myself to like some sort of weird abstract, like fantasy person that I want to be,
right?
Like, or projecting it onto someone who, like, even if it's just like a stranger on the street who you're like, oh, this person is successful and has their shit together and blah, blah, blah. And then you yeah. feel that, but it's funny because that's just like, that person is just a surrogate for your own subconscious insecurities, you know?
Yeah. Like, it's weird. The types of, I've started to do that less and less, comparing myself to other people, or even like the fantasy person comparing myself. Yeah. Cause I used to do that a lot. And there's something that happens as you get older where that part of your mind sort of relaxes a little bit and you're able to see, the reality of things, even the reality behind the fantasy.
Yeah.
A little bit clearer. And the types of people that you kind of project those hopes or project your own desires onto.
Yeah.
You can see the facade and you can realize that there's like, everyone to an extent is, even if they don't feel like an imposter.
Yeah.
There are aspects of every single person's life where they are definitely an imposter. They're just like, you know, it's like, it's all just, for other people, right? It's like a character they're performing.
Yeah. I feel that way in social situations sometimes.
For sure.
But yeah.
Like my own, sorry, were you going to say something?
No.
Like for me, social anxiety is like it's something that I have experienced in the past. It's not as, it's not like my number one anxiety sort of kicker. Like that's not where my anxiety rears its head the most.
Yeah.
But in the times when I have had social anxiety and it's often tied up in a feeling of being an imposter or feeling like everyone is looking at me in a situation and feeling like, minuscule, you know, those situations, my reaction is pure flight. I'm just like, get the fuck out, like get out as soon as possible. Do you know, there's a singer called, Maya Folick. Do you know her?
Uh-uh.
She has a song called Leave the Party Early, I think. And it's, I think one of the lines is like, you leave the party early, there's nothing for me here. And I'm just sure. Like, ah, that is like amazing. It's speaking to me.
Yeah. I feel like that too. I feel like it's hard to, it's weird because I get insecure about feeling like an imposter, I guess, in social situations. Like I feel like I don't fit into a given conversation or I don't align enough with a person to share anything right. with them. And so then I avoid situations and like new relationships and even existing friendships sometimes. Cause I'm like to isolate.
Right. Go ahead.
Oh, but then it's funny because with like, I don't know, with other stuff, like I feel like imposter syndrome is always related to people's work and achievements. And like with those, I don't really feel deluded, but I do feel like I get imposter syndrome over me thinking that I'm being successful. Does that make sense? Like when I feel proud of something I've done, I feel the pride and I feel acknowledgement of something that I've achieved, but then immediately I feel, oh, should I be proud of this? You know what I mean? Like, should I be excited about this? That's more what it's like, instead of never feeling it to begin with.
Okay. So it's like, it's almost like you're self-checking. It's like a guilt thing, right?
Yeah. It's like, I'll feel the pride and the success and like, I have an ego and I'll feel the ego. And then I'll think immediately after that, do I deserve to feel that way? You know?
Right. I mean, that could be related to your sort of like Zen training that you spent, you know, years and years like meditating every day,
right,
and keeping that ego part of yourself in check. Right.
And but the ego is very much there. Like it's always,
you can never kill your ego. Your ego is always going to be there. Right. It's like acknowledging that it exists and not letting it take hold of you, which is, I think, what you're actively doing.
Right.
I don't really see that as problematic. I think that's just like a sobering kind of like, it's the same as like not, you know, counting your chickens before they hatch or like.
Yeah, that's true.
There's one other thing I wanted to say about social anxiety. Oh, you said before that your experiences with social anxiety is like you feel like sometimes you wind up in a conversation where you don't have something to contribute, and you, as a result of that, isolate, right?
Yeah.
And that's something I have learned to do as well. And I think that there's a couple different ways I've isolated myself. One is that I have moved cities a couple of times. So my friend circle, my direct friend circle gets smaller and smaller every time I move.
Yeah.
And my very close friends get further and further away.
Right.
And then on top of that, I have sunk all of my free time into my business, right?
Right.
So I don't think that it's necessarily problematic to isolate yourself in that way. I think that you should maintain your friendships. You should maintain your close friendships.
Yeah.
But the friendships where you're like struggling to find common ground,
yeah,
are not necessarily ones that warrant a lot of effort on your part.
Yeah.
Oh, right? I feel that. It's not sure. Even that. And if you're having like social anxiety about a situation and you're just like, well, I'm going to fucking dip out of this relationship, that's fine. Like that. And it's maybe selfish, but it's like, you have gotten everything out of that relationship that you can, right? Like that's like a very like sort of pragmatic way of looking at it, but, and maybe if like a kind of a
transactional
way of looking at it, but
you have to do that to a certain degree. Otherwise you're kind of just like a sucker, you know, because people will take advantage of that if you don't
sure
keep tabs on it.
Yeah. It's weird. I look at, all of the, like this goes back to looking at people you admire, right? And like want to emulate. But like the people that I've always admired and want to emulate my lifestyle after, or the lifestyle that I've always wanted for myself, is that of a fine artist, right? Like someone who's like a painter, a professional painter.
Same here.
And
that's funny.
And you look at someone like Francis Bacon, whose life was like pretty fraught. It wasn't a life of luxury, but he was able to like carve out a niche for himself in what he wanted to do. And he was very active in defining how his creative legacy would play out even after he was gone.
Yeah.
By like, he actively destroyed canvases that he wasn't fully satisfied with. He limited the supply of his own work, you know, even to the detriment of like his bills or whatever it was. And, but then you look at the people around him, the people that he had in his life, and a lot of those relationships were really antagonistic.
Oh yeah. Those guys were crazy.
And like, even like I, for a painter that I believed in, I would make that sacrifice.
What sacrifice?
Like I would engage in an antagonistic relationship with a creative artist. Right. If I got to be around that creative artist.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's such a, I think that's why that's such a, someone knocking at the door.
Not my door.
Maddie? No? Just some building outside? Sorry. I think that's the thing that's so intoxicating for people about like visual artists who are successful specifically because there's that, they're like very Dionysian and like their lifestyles are very like weird and not conventional, but then they're also achieving because of their output, like a degree of notoriety and financial success that like most people who are that eccentric don't ever achieve.
Right.
It's like the one thing where you're rewarded for being completely outlandish and against the grain.
And because, reckless.
Because the value of your work comes from its newness, at least in contemporary art.
Like, do you know anything about Lucian Freud?
Yeah. I want to read that new book that came out about them.
I would love to read that. Yeah. But like his, like when he signed with that gallery in LA, when he moved from like being a UK spot, like a UK, when he was represented in the UK. Right? Sorry.
Was it Blum and Poe that signed him? They're like the first big gallery.
No, I don't think so. I don't remember. But he was in the UK and he was like massively in debt and his paintings weren't selling well. And then he signed with an American gallerist and the gallerist was like, so, you know, Lucian, just let me know if there's anything you need help with. And he's like, yeah, I'll sign with you. I've got like a small gambling debt I'd like you to take care of. And then the guy was like, yeah, no problem. Uh-huh. So Lucian like signed on with him and he's like, here's where you go to take care of the gambling debt. And he went to the bookie and it was £1 million.
Holy shit.
But the guy had agreed to pay it for him. Like, what? How do you, what That's kind amazing. Of life is that? It's so fucking weird. But at the same time, there's something so romantic about it.
And I think it's funny because that it's another unique situation where that mythology of like how ridiculous their lives are, which you see with so many artists.
Yeah.
Not all artists, but like a lot of the significant artists of the 20th century, their lives are just ridiculous. And like that plays into the mythology, which then plays into how their works are valued because they're valued in such an arbitrary way.
Yeah.
That it's like that those elements of the story is what makes their work valuable.
Right.
Or but it's just that they've been someone decided to. Like I'm listening to this book about contemporary art and I didn't even know that Cy Twombly wasn't like, no one liked Cy Twombly while he was alive. Like
his really?
Work was not, I mean, he was like, he was a notable artist and stuff, but he wasn't like this, like now he's kind of canonical, but when he was alive, it wasn't like that. And then after he died, his estate was purchased by Gagosian, who like put all this effort into legitimizing him and boosting his prices. And now he's like in museums that he wasn't even, I don't think, probably wouldn't have even known that he would have been in previously.
Right. Like not even in consideration.
Yeah.
I think the other part that makes those lifestyles desirable is that they seem so confident in their convictions.
Yeah. I mean, right? I don't feel like it's just, I feel like the artist lifestyle that's desirable would be like the artists that people kind of shit on for being too commercial, like a Tom Sachs or a Jeff Koons or someone who has a very stable personal life. But like when I was working, like I worked for like a week for Raymond Pedbon and I was like, I never felt envious of him. He seemed like a very miserable, confused person. I was just I was starstruck, but I had no interest. Like there was no romanticization of like that lifestyle. I thought it was really bleak, you know?
Okay, but even someone like Raymond Pettibone, that guy's not, I bet he never experiences imposter syndrome. You know?
I don't know what he experiences. I think he's like, he's a really wacky dude. And a lot, I don't know. I think there's just different types of artists, I guess. But
Of course. I mean, there's a million different types of art. There's many different types of people as there are. There's that many different types of artists. But
then someone like Tom Sachs, I don't love his work, but I envy his lifestyle a lot.
Is it just because it generates a lot of money? Like, is it that you just wish to have like...
No, it's because it's because I'm a control freak and he's like very obviously like mastered the art of being a control freak and has this incredible closed end system that he applies to everything and tweaks based on performance, not just like financial performance, but like based on how smoothly the machine runs. And like, that's right. Very enviable to me. Like, so having a compound and having like running it like a business where everything is perfectly organized and everything is accounted for.
Yeah. It's like it's something that has taken the decision-making out of a lot of stuff, right? Cause that's what a lot of your and my work is inventing and implementing and fine tuning systems, right? That I didn't know that's what my job was going to be, but that's essentially what my job is.
Right.
When you really break it down. Like, I thought my job when I started this as a business would be like, oh, I'm going to draw. I'm just going to draw all the time. It'll be great. What my job is like figuring out the most streamlined way to ship things out all over the world. It's like, it takes a lot of energy. And once you figure that out, then you're like figuring out the best way to organize your internal system to streamline that part of it, you know?
Right. But then if you forget to draw new things, there's no point in having the...
Right. So you've got to find the balance, right? So I'm back on trying to figure out how to draw every day. And then it's getting closer to the painter's lifestyle somehow, right?
Yeah. Well, I think the thing about the art, like an artist lifestyle that I find so appealing is like the idea that you can set set parameters in motion that you adhere to, that enable you to only do the work that you want to do.
Right.
Like
you remove all anything extraneous.
Right. Like artists outsource all of the creative and logistical work that they don't want to do to galleries, assistants, et cetera. It's a very simple system. And then their process, like most of their time is spent creating and socializing because those are the two things that are most important, like that they have the most value for them. And I think that's what, not the socializing part necessarily, but the like just having time to think and like, think about stuff, strategize stuff, be creative, read, you know?
Yeah.
It's very old school. It's like very Greek, like having a noble lifestyle where you have the resources and the time to just like think and study. You don't have to do anything else.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the ultimate goal, right? It's just getting to a place where you can consume that type of like autodidact, just learn for yourself whatever it is you want and then produce things based on what you've learned.
Right.
Like that's the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel like I'm getting closer.
Maddie got this really, we were at this bookstore over the weekend and she got this really cool book about, it's like a photography book through the South, and it's like all this outsider art from the South.
Yeah.
And I've just started reading it and I read the intro, and in the intro there was a quote from one of the artists who was saying like that it, like to make kind of, he had creative impulse to make like what was a very kind of barren life more tolerable. And so then he started making things, and he's like, once you start making the things, you learn how to make the things better. Like there's no outside influence. It's just like you're actively doing this thing, and then in doing it, you're getting better at it, even if you can't really define what the thing that you're doing is, which I really like that being put that way, because it's like,
do you feel like that describes you?
What?
Do you feel like that describes you?
Yeah. Like ideally, like doing like trying something new and then learning a new skill as you go. In your own way is like, that's what I enjoy most about working, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you seem like the type of person that is like eagerly and actively pursuing that kind of stuff, right? Like, you teach me stuff that I don't have the patience or wherewithal to learn on my own often.
Right. Like, I just launched this new, I like migrated my site over to Shopify, which is like the simplest thing ever.
But it sounds like a Shopify ad, but it's not.
I've been trying to do it. I've been wanting to do it for like 2 years, and I paid for a site like 8 months ago, almost a year ago, and I still hadn't done it. And so, like, if financial gain was my primary motivator, I would have done it immediately, because it's definitely like a more profitable way to run the business. But I, like, for some reason put it off. But then, like, when I was ready, when I was feeling restless and like ready to learn a new skill, that's what I did. I just like woke up on Friday and got it all set up and launched it in like 3 hours. And it felt silly, but then I was like, oh, I'm doing this because I like now feel like I want to learn this new skill, and like I have the time to learn it, you know?
You have like the mental space that's available in order to do it properly. And I mean, you've had a lot going on recently, like you moved and...
Yeah. And then last year I had the dog, was still a puppy, and I was all this stuff. I don't know. I just kept putting it off. But like, but then the appeal for it is not all, it's not purely like financial or businessy. It's like the idea of trying to learn this new system,
right,
is what's appealing to me. And then the cool thing about certain things with business is like when you learn that system, it ends up being more profitable for you.
Yeah.
If you,
well, it's also that you're looking at things with a fresh eye, right? It's like,
yeah,
I feel like if you had applied the same sort of, I mean, maybe not, because Shopify gives you a lot more tools to work with, but I feel like even if it wasn't Shopify, if it was any other thing and you had just applied yourself to it, it's just that you were ready to do it, right?
Mm-hmm. Completely arbitrarily, like just, you know, there was no real reason to do it then versus 6 months ago versus 6 months from now. But
are we still talking about imposter syndrome?
No, we're not. But do we ever stay on topic?
Sometimes. I don't know.
Well, but I think the other thing, though, the other thing that connects to this, I think it's why I thought of it, was like, I find myself getting that imposter syndrome most when I get stuck in a routine that I haven't fucked with in a long time.
Right.
If I'm just doing the same thing every week for months on end and like not changing any parts of the machine or like learning any new skills or anything, I get too comfortable. And then if anything bad happens that makes me insecure, like if I have like a bad sales week or even a bad sales day, it'll throw me into this funk where I feel like a fraud and a failure. And then I'll do something to change my routine that like feels beneficial or feels like it's improving my own approach.
That's smart. I mean, that you're able to like actively realize it. And
because I'm really hard on myself. So when it's not hard to realize it, because it's like, oh, I suddenly just fall into this like extreme state of self-doubt that lasts for like a very short period of time, but is very intense. And then always out of that, I will make some sort of change, whether it's a good change or a bad change. That,
I mean, that's the lesson right there, right? It's just like, because a lot of people go through that, not just for weeks, they go through it for years or a lifetime, right? Where they're like afraid to make the change because of something arbitrary, right? And you yourself just said like this massive change that you just did, I mean, as technical as it was, like migrating your site to a new platform, that's something you put off for 2 years. But when you actually buckled down and got to it, it took you 3 or 4 hours, right?
Right, exactly.
And it's for like, in the last 2 years, there's been plenty of times when you've had 4 hours free, right?
Yeah.
But you doing the thing, I don't know. Sometimes these things feel like the smallest task can feel like fucking Mount Everest sometimes, right?
Yeah.
And just starting to do it, or like getting the, I hate to use all these fucking cliche phrases, but they're so true. Like yeah. getting, once you get the ball rolling, like,
true though.
You know, putting one foot in front of the other and like, you know, all of that actually makes sense.
Burning the candle at both ends.
Yeah, burning the candle.
All your chickens in one basket.
Just like the older I get, the more my brain defaults to just dadisms.
Yeah, it's hilarious. Me too.
But I think that just comes with, you know, older you get. Sorry, I was going to say another cliche.
That's good. You can lead a horse to water.
I was going to say the one about like, what is it? It's like old age and treachery will beat youth and vigor every time.
That is true. It's treacherous out there, folks.
Sure is. Yeah, I don't know. For me, the other part of like imposter syndrome is that there is this. Like I just did this market over the weekend, like a punk rock flea market for Inner Decay. And the who you have like in your mind as who your customer is,
yeah,
is never who your customer is. It never matches what you imagine.
Yeah.
Because who I imagine my customer is me.
Really? Right?
Yeah, because I'm like, oh, the person who's going to like this art is going to be like the creator of the art, right?
Right. But that's not true, though.
No, I know.
People who buy Francis Bacon's art are probably like as far from being like Francis Bacon as imaginable.
Yes. I know that it's a naive position. I understand that completely. But there is still a part of me that's like, huh, you're my customer. Like, and it's not, I'm not like, it's not a bad thing at all. Like,
yeah.
I'm not saying like, oh my God, you're my customer. What am I doing?
There's like, a funny like feeling though. Then people just do that.
That who you imagine buying, like at something that is called like the punk rock flea market. You have a pretty good idea of who your customer is going to be. And even with that prerequisite, I'm still surprised.
Yeah.
You know? And like yesterday when I did this market, my youngest customer of the day was probably 8 years old.
That's awesome.
And my oldest customer was probably 75.
Also awesome.
And the amount of boomers who are like just fucking tickled pink by the patches I make is mind-boggling. Like, they think it's so funny. All the stuff that people who are my age or your age think is really kind of like dark and edgy, which is not really what the impetus of any of the art I make is.
Right.
It's always a little bit tongue in cheek, but it's very easy to interpret as this kind of edgier thing.
Yeah.
It's the sort of older generation is the one that kind of gets it as they get the humorous aspect of it more.
That's funny. Yeah.
I
have that when I'm scrolling, when I like on Instagram all the time, like if someone comments or something or DMs me, I'll look at their profile.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, huh, interesting. You know, like I didn't, you don't think of the different people who are interested in something.
Right.
But then that is a funny, I like that, like having that diversity of.
It's great. I mean, it's so cool because.
I was trained.
Sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, it gives me hope.
It does. Yeah. Well, and it's fun. It's nice to like expose yourself to, I think, people who are different from you. But it was funny because like I was kind of trained to do this, the basics of what I'm doing now by guys who were like really intent on making their customers be them, you know,
right.
which is like most cool guy companies.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, I learned the same way. And
that's not a sustainable strategy.
No.
Because then you like walk down the street and you see like frat boys in college wearing the t-shirt that you made. And you're like, oh, they're not like skate rats, you know, or they're not real, you know, they're not like really cool.
Well, whatever. You don't get to define it.
Yeah. You don't get to choose what it is.
And that's part of the beauty. Right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Some people get really like kind of pissed about that though. Like they only want like cool people wearing their stuff.
Well, what is cool? I don't know.
Everybody's I don't know. Cool. You get these weird. Nobody's that's cool. why I think I find those brands really interesting because their fan bases develop in this very restricted way where, either by like cost restriction or the subject matter is like too kind of out there to get a normal person. Or
it's weird because there's all these like those brands that are cool, like you're talking about.
Yeah,
I have this idea of. Like their success. And when I get down on the success of my brand, I compare myself to them and I'm like, oh, they sold out of this thing immediately.
Yeah.
What they don't tell you is they made 20 of it.
Right. Right.
You know? So like, yeah.
they're more, they like get off more on the idea that of the limited.
Right. Value. It's just like, it's a, what am I trying to say? Limited. You said it.
I had a funny moment though. I thought about that the other day. Cause there's like in New York, there's like guys who have those brands who are the cool brands, you know, for the only for the cool guys, you know? And then there's like people who are in that community also of like New York cool guys who have brands where they just like have fun with it and they don't care who wears it.
Right.
And I love that the most. Cause it's last year I had a brief conversation with Sean Pablo, who has the he's a skateboarder and has the Paradise New York is his brand.
Yeah.
And I don't know. He's just like a kid, like a skate kid, you know, is successful and like, you know, skates on Supreme and fucking awesome and stuff. And then he has this goofy brand that he just does it almost seems like for fun. It definitely does really well. So like, it's not just for fun, but like, just, you can tell he just has fun with the designs and they kind of appeal to a weirdly wide set of people. And then, so I'm just like a bigger fan of his brand than I am a lot of those other New York brands that try to like only cater to like cool stuff, you know?
Right.
And then I was watching the Keeping Up with the Kardashians with Maddie the other day and the Kourtney Kardashian was wearing one of his hoodies. And I was like, that's awesome. Because that's like when you enable that open-endedness, if you're making something, whether you're an artist or whatever, and you kind of just like do it in a way that's fun to you without caring too much about who the audience or the customer is.
Yeah.
I feel like you get funny things like that.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's like I feel like that's all of us who have brands on the internet now. Where that's our main marketing. And unless you're only targeting certain people when you, I don't know, you know?
Yeah. But I think it's much cooler for that to happen on accident, which it very obviously did.
Right.
Because the irreverence is what's cool. And then someone who's like that in a high up position, like is told by other people what is cool and then wears that hoodie. But the guy who made the hoodie is just doing it for fun.
Yeah.
And doesn't really care that she's wearing it and like didn't pay her $1 million to wear it because wouldn't do that, you know?
Yeah. That's funny. Being more irreverent. I've been adding more irreverent shit to my own brand.
Yeah. I just like to, it's fun to just, I do a lot of like found designs and found imagery and stuff like old stuff from old manuscripts and like weird old logos. I don't know, just like weird stuff like that I find. And then that's the most fun because I can just do it based on my own, what I think is funny or good and then make it. And then it's funny how some of the stuff does really well. Some of it does really badly, but it's fun to just like do what you want to do and put it out and see what happens.
That's getting back to that place is so it's weird because it's basically like, I feel like it's the same with everything. Like, as soon as you don't really care, as soon as you're doing it not for anyone else, but just for yourself, that's when people start to notice. And that's why I feel like my brand had its initial success, is that I was in that mindset. And then something changed when I started treating it more like a business. It became harder and harder. I mean, it became harder to make new products when I was thinking about it too much. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. But I feel like it's the same, like actors talk about that, where they're like, the one audition that they landed that was like their biggest audition is the one that they cared least about.
Right.
Or they like, we're like, oh, there's no fucking way I'm getting this thing. And then they go in and do it, and they just like act like they don't care. And the director is kind of bamboozled by that, by that nonchalance. And they're like, holy fuck, who is that guy? And being able to get to that state is like what I'm striving for. Right.
Right.
And maybe that's why I feel like more of an imposter these days, is because I haven't been acting in that state.
Yeah, when you're acting less truly to what you think is yourself.
Right.
But then finding the balance where you can do both, where you can like run a business properly and then also have the energy to do creative. That kind of goes back to when we were talking about compartmentalization. Like being able to do both is a very valuable skill, I feel like. Which I think that's what artists do really well if they have long careers, is like they're able to evolve creatively and also manage the machine that is their own.
Yeah. Output. Oh man.
But then it's also why there's such romantic ideals about the artists who didn't live very long, who like had these, who had like a Francis Bacon or something, who like doesn't have like a big breadth of work that changed drastically at any point. You know what I mean? Yeah. But then like someone like Philip Guston, who changed extremely drastically multiple times in their career, is so cool because they were able to manage that both sides. Right. You know?
Yeah. We're making breakthroughs here, Charlie.
Breakthroughs. I thought this book would be stupid, but it's actually pretty good. It's called Boom.
What's this one? This is the
recent book about the history of the contemporary art market, like how it ended up where it is. It's called Boom. It like starts with, you know, basically starts with the abstract expressionists and like Leo Castelli, and then works its way forward to present day, how the market developed and how the relationship between dealers and artists developed and auction houses and all that.
Right. But isn't it, it's so broken now. It's weird.
Yeah. Like, I mean, that's what it's getting to. It's kind of showing the seeds, showing how that all started.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Like how I always thought like Leo Castelli was this really like self-made guy basically.
Yeah.
But he was it was his father-in-law's, he was using his father-in-law's money to when he first started.
It's always something like that.
Yeah. It's funny. Except
there's not a lot of new money out there.
No. Yeah.
It's always like, some family thing, some family fortune, or some trust fund, or some.
Yeah.
It's weird. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Part of me is jealous of that funding. I'm like, I wish I just had not to worry about money. But then a part of me is like, well, I probably wouldn't be doing anything satisfying if that was the case.
I find it weird because it makes me feel alienated from people who are in that position, because I'm like, I can't imagine the decisions that I would make and the way that my life would be if I was in that position. And so then people who are like aliens to me.
Yeah.
I like don't get it. I can't wrap my head around it.
Yeah. It's bizarre.
Yeah. I think maybe I like don't respect it. To a certain degree, which is
here's the goal. You can't, we just change. Get so successful that we create that terrible situation for our children.
Well, it's funny. It is kind of sad because it's like you don't ask to be born. It's like, oh, boo-hoo, someone, a trust fund kid or whatever. But you don't ask to be put in that position. And then it's like, if you do want to organically make something for yourself, I would imagine it's kind of probably the imposter syndrome is just as strong with someone who has infinite family funds at their disposal to like start a company or something. I don't feel like sorry for them, but I do feel definitely like I'm sure they have their own struggles because no one takes you as seriously when you're.
Well, a lot of it, nobody knows the story. A lot
also,
of
no one cares though, because money talks.
Yeah, nobody knows the story and nobody gives a fuck anymore. Yeah. It's,
the weird thing is moving back to a big city and remembering just how many people there are who are using other people's money to do everything they do.
Yeah.
Whether it's investor money or parents' money, it's like crazy, you know?
Yeah.
You can sense it. You can sniff it out.
Like Rambo is sniffing your feet right now.
Yeah, he's scratching his back with his leg. He's making a funny face.
I feel like we hit on all the salient points of imposter syndrome earlier in the episode, so I don't know how to wrap this up now.
Yeah, I don't know. I think some parting thoughts. I don't know. I guess
this is usually where you come in with something that ties it all together.
My South Park moral of the story.
Yeah.
I feel like the way to overcome imposter syndrome is to try to look honestly at yourself,
right,
and your routines, and like what triggers that feeling, and then make changes that you can kind of handle and keep learning new things so that you don't feel like you're, I feel like for me, it comes from settling too much into thinking I know what I'm doing. Thinking I know what I'm doing. And then when I realize that there's other things I can learn and I can challenge myself to expand into those new things, I feel like I'm doing the work of growing and changing, and then I feel less like an imposter.
Right. I mean, that
challenging yourself and putting yourself into the unknown is actually the secret to getting over that feeling. Because when you feel too secure, or like, you know, like you're too confident in your knowledge, that's when you feel like an imposter.
Yeah. I can get behind that. I mean, that, I feel like you've solved it, Charlie. Oh, there it is, folks.
We put off the Israeli, we're going to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict next week, folks.
Yeah.
We were going to do that this week, but.
Sorry, you have to wait one more week.
One more week.
All right. You've been listening to Normal Adult Human. Please subscribe on iTunes and leave us a review there. And until next time, I'm Morgan Watt.
I'm Charlie Ambler. Thank you.
Bye. Oh, sorry. Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.